to the Chord Memory Club, the tune from Hamburg to Leipzig, the Shusoki remix. That's about it for me for today. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. My website is at djfirefly.com.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine the lawsuit American Association of University Professors versus Rubio, which challenges federal efforts to deport individuals for their political activism and ideology.
Attorney George Wang of the Knight First Amendment Institute joins us to unpack the case.
Then we'll take an insider's look at Louisville, Kentucky's Office of Inspector General, established after the 2020 police killing of Breonna Taylor.
Inspector General Ed Harness joins us to discuss the role of independent oversight within the Louisville Metro Police Department. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. Sadly, listeners to Law and Disorder are all too familiar with how the Trump administration has systematically created a climate of repression and fear on our university campuses. Federal agencies are attempting to deport multiple individuals for their pro-Palestinian advocacy, including Mahmoud Khalil, a leader of the pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University. These actions have sent chills through the community of non-citizen students and faculty on campuses around the country, causing some to pull out of academic conferences, stay home from protests, and withdraw from other forms of public advocacy and engagement. While Khalil and other students are actively pursuing their own lawsuits and habeas corpus petitions defending their own First Amendment rights, the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University has filed an innovative lawsuit attacking the Trump administration from a different angle. On March 25, 2025, the Knight Institute filed a lawsuit on behalf of the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, and its chapters at Harvard, NYU, and Rutgers, as well as the Middle East Studies Association, alleging that the Trump administration's policy of arresting, detaining, and deporting non-citizen students and faculty who participate in pro-Palestinian activism chills non-citizens from speaking, and by extension robs these organizations and their U.S. citizen members of non-citizens' perspectives on a matter of significant public debate. The suit seeks a court order declaring that the policy is unlawful and enjoining the federal government from enforcing it. In the lawsuit entitled American Association of University Professors versus Rubio, U.S. District Judge William G. Young in Massachusetts denied the government's motion to dismiss and set a trial for July 7. To learn more about this important case and how the trial is going, we're joined by one of the trial lawyers, George Wang. George is a staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute. He has been with the organization for several years. Before that, he was a law clerk for a federal judge on the First Circuit. George received a BA in public policy from Stanford University and a JD from Yale Law School, where he was student director of the Media Freedom and Information Access Clinic. George, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Steve. Really happy to be here.
So you are in this trial. I gather you've been examining witnesses. As far as we're concerned, it's a very important case. Tell us about the plaintiffs and how they have asserted their standing based on their own First Amendment rights, which allegedly are being violated by the Secretary of State.
Yeah, happy to talk about that. So, you know, in March, the Knight First Amendment Institute, where I work, filed a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's policy of arresting, detaining, and deporting non-citizen students and faculty who participate in pro-Palestinian speech and activism. And we filed this lawsuit on behalf of our clients, the American Association of University Professors, three AAUP campus chapters, and the Middle East Studies Association, to put a stop to the Trump administration's policy of ideological deportation. So a bit about our clients, our plaintiffs, who we feel extremely honored and lucky to work for. The AAUP is a union and a membership organization of faculty and academic professionals who are dedicated to advancing academic freedom and shared governance. They have members and chapters at universities across the country, including at Rutgers, NYU, and Harvard. Those are the three local chapters that we represent in this lawsuit. And then there's also the Middle East Studies Association, MESA. They're a scholarly association that fosters the study of the Middle East and encourages public understanding of the region and its peoples. You know, they put on programs, services, and events. They publish journals, and they bring together scholars of the Middle East in academic exchange and discourse in order to further their mission. And, you know, our clients, the AAUP and MESA, we argue have standing in two ways. First, they have associational standing, or standing to represent their members' interests. You know, both organizations have members who have been harmed by the Trump administration's ideological deportation policy. They've been harmed by having their speech chilled, by withdrawing from groups, withdrawing from protests that they would ordinarily attend, and even changing their social media presence and their public writing. You know, they've essentially had to engage in self-censorship due to the Trump administration's policy. Second, the AAUP and MESA have standing in their own right. Both organizations have seen non-citizen members withdraw due to fear of the Trump administration's policies. And they've also diverted substantial resources to addressing the concerns from their members that stem from these policies.
George, opening arguments were heard on July 7th. If you would, could you please summarize the arguments advanced by each side?
I'd be happy to do that. So in our opening statement, my colleague, Ramya Krishnan, you know, essentially laid out what the evidence at trial will show. And we're confident that the evidence will show that, first, there's a cross-government effort led by the Department of State and Homeland Security to target, arrest, and deport non-citizens for their protected speech and advocacy, and specifically for their pro-Palestinian expression. And second, that this policy has created a climate of fear and repression at universities across the country that has chilled the speech and association of the AAUP and MESA's members, and, as I mentioned before, has harmed these organizations themselves. And all of this, as we argued in our opening statement, has created a culture of repression not seen since the McCarthy era. And we're confident that by presenting all of this evidence at trial, we're going to show that the First Amendment has been violated by the Trump administration's policies. The government also made an opening statement. And in its opening statement, the government's primary message seemed to be that the Trump administration's ideological deportation policy, you know, its policy of targeting these non-citizens based on their political speech, they've argued that it's all made up. And moreover, that our plaintiffs' members' fears are fictional and overblown. That seems to be their main message. You know, interestingly, during their opening statement, the government initially conceded that non-citizens lawfully present in the U.S. have the same First Amendment rights as citizens. But over the course of the argument, and after some questioning from the judge, later walked back that concession a little bit, claiming that there are, quote, nuances related to immigration and national security and foreign policy involved in that. The government has not begun to make their case yet. That's going to happen tomorrow, first on Friday. So we'll see what evidence the government is going to present to back up its theory of the case.
Yes, this is such a dynamic situation. We are recording this interview on Thursday, and our listeners will begin to hear it next Monday. I wanted you to share with us some of what the witnesses that you've called so far in the case have testified to. It's valuable that this trial is allowing you to put on direct evidence of the chilling effects that you're describing. This is no longer argument. This is no longer speculation. So tell us about the witnesses you've put on so far and some of the highlights of their testimony.
You know, the place that I want to begin is just by acknowledging that it takes an incredible amount of bravery for people who are potentially subject to this policy that we're challenging, a policy that we say targets non-citizens on the basis of their political speech. For witnesses who fall in that category to come forward and testify at trial. And so I just want to start by acknowledging the bravery of those witnesses and how much we have appreciated working with those witnesses. We have thus far called several witnesses to help back up our case, and I'm happy to talk through a few of them. We began with Professor Megan Hiska. She's a philosophy professor at Northwestern University, and she's a legal permanent resident, a green card holder. Professor Hiska testified that because of the government's ideological deportation policy, she curtailed her protest activity, she refrained from publishing an op-ed that she drafted, and she declined to pursue leadership positions in a political organization that she belongs to. And she did all of this, especially after seeing the videos of Mahmoud Halil and Rumeysa Ozturk's arrests. You know, I think she was particularly concerned that because she was thinking about publishing an op-ed that would be critical of the government, that she might be next after Ms. Ozturk. We also presented a testimony from Nadia Al-Ali. She's a member of both the AAUP and MESA, and she's also a legal permanent resident, a green card holder, and she's an anthropology and Middle Eastern studies professor at Brown University. Professor Al-Ali testified that because of the government's policy, she pulled out of research fellowships abroad that would have required her to travel to the Middle East. She stopped pursuing an academic writing project that related to Palestine. And she explained that since the arrests of Ms. Ozturk and Mr. Khalil, she has refrained from signing public letters or engaging in public advocacy on Palestine. And especially as a scholar of the Middle East, and especially gender studies in the Middle East, this has been a big blow to Professor Al-Ali. And her testimony was really compelling and riveting. We also presented testimony from Bernard Nickel, who is a philosophy professor at Harvard. Professor Nickel is a member of the AUP and also specifically Harvard's local chapter of the AUP. Professor Nickel testified that he stopped attending protests, stopped signing public statements related to Palestine, and also canceled important international travel after learning about Ms. Ozturk's arrest. So these are just three examples of non-citizen members of the AUP or MESA who have been forced to self-censor and have been chilled by the administration's policy of targeting non-citizens just like them for engaging in pro-Palestinian advocacy. We also had a citizen testify, specifically Professor Nadia Abu Al-Haj. She's a U.S. citizen and an anthropology professor at Barnard in Columbia. You know, she testified about the effect that Mr. Khalil's arrest had on Columbia's campus and her students. And she testified that his arrest terrified her non-citizen students into silence. And she spoke about the climate on Columbia's campus after the arrests, both Mr. Khalil and as well as Mr. Mohsin Madawi, another Columbia University student. And she spoke extremely compellingly about the level of anxiety that students, including both non-citizen and citizen students, felt after those arrests really shook the campus. Those have been the sort of main witnesses that we have presented so far. We will have more to come in the second week of the trial.
George, has the government indicated who they intend to call as witnesses? And what do you anticipate the government will try to bring out through those witnesses?
Yeah, so far, and again, this is speaking on Thursday, July 10th, we've only heard from one government official, and this was a senior Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE official named Peter Hatch. Mr. Hatch was a witness that we had called. And Mr. Hatch testified that the agency ICE assembled a team that was referred to internally as the Tiger Team in early 2025 to specifically investigate student protesters. This Tiger Team rapidly compiled over 100 reports based on a list of 5,000 people identified on the website Canary Mission and by other organizations like Beitar US. And Mr. Hatch helps lead an office within ICE's Homeland Security Investigations Division that compiles background reports on targets of the agency's investigations. Today, Mr. Hatch was also shown in court the dossiers that had been prepared about several of the individuals who had been targeted for deportation, including the dossiers prepared on Ms. Ozturk, Mr. Khalil, Mr. Khan Suri, Ms. Young So Chung. And in his testimony, Mr. Hatch acknowledged that these profiles included information directly sourced from the website Canary Mission, and also highlighted these individuals' writing and protest activities related to pro-Palestinian expression. So this was, I think, an incredibly important revelation about the nature of the team that had been assembled, again, in early 2025 to investigate student protesters, sourcing many of their leads from the website Canary Mission, that is known for having profiles on individuals that it considers anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, specifically highlighting these individuals' writing and protest activities. That's just been one government official. Over the course of the next week and a half, the government will likely call a number of other government officials. That includes other senior State Department and Department of Homeland Security officials, as well as, it appears, people who appear to be the supervising agents for a number of the individuals who have been already detained. We are handing over the case to the government tomorrow, essentially, tomorrow meaning Friday. And so we'll see the order and which people they end up calling and what they have to say. But already through Mr. Hatch's testimony, we've learned a lot about this ideological deportation policy that we're challenging through this lawsuit.
George, I am just chilled by what you're telling us today. You are in real time documenting things that are reminiscent of the McCarthy period, of the collection of data on college professors and students that I is terrifying to think is happening in real time in the United States of America. In a way, it answers my next question. Why did the Knight First Amendment Institute take on this case, and where do you see it fitting in the panoply of litigation that is pending across the United States to try to restrain and hold accountable the Trump administration?
Steve, you know, it really is chilling. And I think it was chilling when the videos of the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil and Ramesa Ozturk came out, and it's been all the more chilling to learn through the course of this litigation the inner workings of the ideological deportation policy that we're challenging through this lawsuit. So the information that has come out over the last 2 days and likely will come out over the trial really does have, I think, horrific implications for where our democracy is right now. As you said, this does sort of answer the question of why we at the Knight First Amendment Institute thought it was so important to take on this case. You know, this lawsuit was a response to the climate of fear and repression on university campuses across the country created by the Trump administration's unlawful attempts to target people for their political speech. After seeing the administration's threats directed at students across the country for engaging in pro-Palestinian speech and protests, and then the horrifying arrest of Mr. Khalil and others, we felt it was important to bring this kind of challenge. You know, these actions and the administration's related threats have sent chills through the community of non-citizen students and faculty who call these college campuses home. And it's made many of them terrified to participate in public protests, sign public statements, share their views on social media, and even take on academic opportunities. They are literally terrified that masked ICE agents are going to seize them from their homes, from the sidewalks, and for what? Because they simply said what they believed in. This kind of targeting violates the First Amendment, and it violates it because the government simply has no authority to arrest, detain, and deport people for their lawful political expression. You know, I work for a place called the Knight First Amendment Institute, and if the First Amendment means anything, it has to mean that people cannot be deported simply for speaking their mind. I think this lawsuit comes down to, and our participation in this case comes down to, is that we believe that students and faculty shouldn't have to live in fear that engaging in constitutionally protected political expression will result in ICE agents seizing them from their homes. You know, these are fears we ordinarily associate with the most repressive regimes in the world. And it is truly shocking to see this unfolding right here at home. I think it's completely inconsistent with the First Amendment, and it's inconsistent with the fundamental principles of our democracy. Another fundamental part of our case relates to the right of the public to hear from these individuals who have been chilled. The First Amendment has long been found to protect not only the right of speakers to speak, but also the right of listeners to hear. And one of the theories that has been in our case from the very beginning has been the idea that the Trump administration's ideological deportation policy not only chills the speech of non-citizens who are directly affected by the policy, but also anyone in the country, citizen or non-citizen, who wishes to hear them speak. And as I mentioned before, this is a principle that has been long established in Supreme Court jurisprudence, in our First Amendment case law. You know, in particular, there's a case from the 60s, from 1965, called Lamont versus Postmaster General, that really solidified for the first time that American listeners have a right to hear from sources, including from sources that themselves do not have First Amendment rights. At issue in that case, in Lamont, was a law that required anyone who wanted to receive so-called communist political propaganda to first send to the post office a postcard that said that they wanted to receive this information. Essentially, every time any piece of so-called communist political propaganda was sent to you, instead of getting the actual mail, you would get a card that you had to check that said, yes, I want to receive this. This was challenged under the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court unanimously found that Americans have a right to receive information, including information from abroad, and including from information from speakers who have no First Amendment rights in the first place. And that has been, you know, an important thread that we at the Knight Institute have worked on a lot, and also that's an important part of our case here, because this case is not just about the right of non-citizen students and faculty to be able to speak about pro-Palestinian viewpoints and ideas without the fear of deportation. It's also about the right of all of us to be able to listen to them, and the right of their colleagues and their students to hear from them as well.
George, what remedies are the plaintiffs seeking?
So we're seeking multiple kind of remedies. You know, for one, we're seeking a declaration from the court that the policy is illegal and it violates the First Amendment. We're also seeking injunctive relief. We want to put a stop to the policy. And so we're seeking an injunction against the Trump administration that will prevent them from enforcing this unconstitutional policy. We're also seeking relief under the Administrative Procedures Act, which should give us, you know, a different kind of relief to the injunctive and declaratory relief that we're seeking here.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. This is Stephen Rohde, co-host, along with Heidi Boghossian. And today we're joined by George Wang, an attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute. George, we understand the government is claiming under a Cold War statute that the Secretary of State by his own fiat, can expel permanent residents if they are found to have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States. Are you challenging that provision in this case as applied to your plaintiffs and the victims of that policy? And are you seeking a ruling on its constitutionality?
So we are challenging that troubling foreign policy provision only to the extent that it is a part of the ideological deportation policy that is at the center of our challenge. So to the extent that the Trump administration is relying on those provisions to effectuate the ideological deportation policy that we're challenging, you know, we're also challenging that set. But, you know, I think the most important thing is the court does not need to go that far of finding those provisions unconstitutional. Rather, all it needs to do is take a look at the evidence that is before it and will come before it over the next couple of weeks that will show the existence and creation of this policy of targeting non-citizen students and faculty for deportation based on their political speech, and put a stop specifically to that policy, whether it relies on those foreign policy provisions or other provisions of the immigration statutes. You know, the main focus of our case is stopping that policy.
George, how can listeners follow the trial, and how can they learn more about the Knight First Amendment Institute?
Well, listeners can follow the trial by signing up for a live stream link via the court's website. The trial right now is before the United States District Court for the District of Massachusetts, and specifically Judge William Young. The court's website will have a link that they can sign up to register for a live stream of the trial each day that the trial is going on. The trial is going to be continuing over the course of the next week, ending on Friday, July 18th. Listeners should feel free to sign up there. They can also follow the trial through our website, which is knightcolumbia.org, and that's Knight with a K. We're posting daily trial updates there, along with the full transcripts of each trial day on our website. You'll also be able to see commentary of what's happening every day and stay up to date on exactly what's coming out with this trial.
George, we're so grateful you took some precious time, literally in the midst of this trial, to join us on Law and Disorder today. We promise to follow this trial and keep our listeners up to date. Thank you for joining us and for all you do at the Knight First Amendment Institute.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve and Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. In the wake of Breonna Taylor's 2020 murder, the city of Louisville, Kentucky, created the Office of Inspector General. The purpose was to provide independent oversight of the Louisville Metro Police Department. In 2021, Ed Harness was appointed the city's first inspector general, tasked with investigating police misconduct and recommending policy reforms. His term ends this November, and community groups, including the Louisville NAACP, are calling for his reappointment. But questions remain about how local reforms will be enforced, especially as the federal government steps back. A recent executive order gives the U.S. Attorney General authority to unilaterally end consent decrees, raising concerns about long-term accountability. Today, we're joined by Ed Harness to talk about the future of police oversight in Louisville. A former U.S. Army military police officer and Milwaukee police officer, Ed previously served as executive director of the Civilian Police Oversight Agency in Albuquerque. He also led the Dispute Resolution Division of the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau. In addition to his duties in Louisville, he serves as a board member at large for the National Association of Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. Ed, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I think this is my very first podcast.
Well, welcome. Can you briefly describe the mission of Louisville's Office of Inspector General and how it contributes to police accountability?
Well, we have two essential areas that we review as it relates to the police department and contributes to accountability. We do complaint investigations, and we investigate six areas of complaint or misconduct. They are excessive force, sex misconduct, discrimination in the provision of police services, abuse of police authority, and then serious injury or death for an individual in custody or as a result of a police action or inaction. And besides those types of complaint investigations, we also do non-complaint investigations and reviews where we can examine and review Louisville Metro Police Department operations.
Ed, your office was created, I understand, in direct response to the Breonna Taylor death. How has that tragic killing shaped your priorities and the approach to your work over the past 3 years?
Well, the Breonna Taylor homicide was certainly the impetus for getting some sort of civilian oversight codified by ordinance here in Louisville. But it's my understanding that they had been debating oversight or civilian oversight of the police department for about 10 years. And so finally, based upon that tragic incident with Breonna Taylor's homicide, they finally got something passed. And so they put together the ordinance, which created the Civilian Review and Accountability Board, 11 member volunteer members of the community. And it also created the Office of Inspector General, which has the professional staff that facilitates the operations. Our priorities are outlined in the ordinance, and we strive to make sure that we carry out our duties as outlined. I really am a stay-in-your-lane guy. We operate from a neutral position, but we advocate for our role as an agency and our part in public safety, very cognizant of the fact that we need to make sure that we just call balls balls and strike strikes and evaluate the evidence as we gather it.
Now, Ed, I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that your work has faced significant resistance, including from denied access to body cam footage, to officers refusing interviews. Is that accurate? And has the River City Fraternal Order of Police, the union, become any more cooperative in that respect?
Well, what you describe is true, was true, and we still face some of those obstacles now. We do have a memorandum of understanding with the department as it relates to producing the personnel that we compel to come and talk to us. They are compelled to cooperate with our investigations under the ordinance. One of the issues we had initially was how do we compel those investigations and interviews and make sure that we follow the guidelines in the collective bargaining agreement and the case law regarding guarantee and compelled statements. So we did develop an MOU to make that happen. We also now have direct access to all body camera video, so we can go in and look at those directly without having to have the department produce those. Our real obstruction and hurdles have been with the command staff of the department as opposed to the FOP. We've met with the FOP several times and actually agreed on many issues, which many people find surprising, but really are the obstacles that we continue to face are with the command staff of the department itself.
Well, perhaps in that connection, in 2023, Louisville entered into a consent decree with the Department of Justice. But what impact could that have, allowing the Attorney General to unilaterally end such decrees under the new Trump administration? What impact could that have on that consent decree?
It's a really good question, in that it should be pretty black and white that we believe that the consent decree is gone, and therefore we will have no federal enforcement of this negotiated agreement between Louisville Metro Police Department and the Department of Justice. That motion was filed in the middle of May, and the judge has yet to actually sign that order. Much speculation as to why. I think some people believe he's going to write a position paper coming out against consent decrees, and that's been the delay. I don't believe that anybody holds out any hope that this judge is not going to actually dismiss the case. So then the question is, where does that leave us? So in the absence of a consent decree that is federally enforced, the mayor and the chief have entered into what they are calling a community commitment. It mirrors the consent decree. It is not exact. It's a bit watered down. And so we are going to be in this experiment of essentially a private consent decree. And some of the unanswered questions are, what happens if there's non-compliance with the paragraphs of the consent decree as evaluated by a monitor, because the community commitment does create a position for a monitor to come in, much like there would be in a consent decree. But it doesn't really describe what happens if there's non-compliance as evaluated by the monitor. And right now, it appears that all those remedies are left with elected officials, and most specifically, the mayor at this point.
Ed, could you describe some of the key provisions of that consent decree, and what kinds of abuses was the consent decree meant to address?
Well, the consent decree was meant to address 8 specific areas as found in the DOJ investigation with their pattern and practice. There was use of force, there was bias in policing with traffic stops and search warrants, there was sex misconduct, and those are outlined in the findings letter. And so the consent decree mirrored those particular areas of misconduct, the broad areas of misconduct, and then set out specific actions that must be taken and then specific objectives that must be met. The community commitment mirrors the objectives that must be met. It changes some of the methodology for how they are to be met. One example would be what our area is in civilian complaints. So it mandates that our office must exist, that the department must advertise and market our office as an avenue for civilian complaints. It also outlines some budgeting provisions, that our budget must be independent, and it sets up a rainy day fund for us operationally, in that we are allowed to hold on to excess funds until we have 1 complete year of operational expenses as a rainy day fund before any monies are returned to the general fund. So those are the general areas, and it specifies how the department has to respond to our recommendations and our complaints. It also specifies that we are allowed to monitor internal affairs complaints, personnel complaints, and that we must be advised of any civilian complaint that comes to the department.
Ed, if the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division in fact steps away from its role protecting communities from the kind of systemic policing abuses you've referred to, it seems we're starting a circular process. Do you think there will be more lawsuits? Can that fill the gap, or do we face a real enforcement vacuum?
There will be an enforcement vacuum. There's no question about that, because we, as the Inspector General, have no enforcement capabilities. So we have our role, and certainly the civil courts can fill that gap, but I don't believe that they can do it in a timely or an economically efficient manner. So for an example, when this brings me back to why a consent decree is, I believe, important, and a monitor is important as a part of that, where the public sometimes believes that a monitor is an inefficient way of looking at police misconduct. When you look at over the last 10 years, Louisville Metro government has paid out over $100 million in civil settlements and judgments. That amount of money would pay for a lot more police on the streets, pay for a lot more police equipment, and that is money that could go to the root causes of crime. But that's a slow process, and it will not help change the culture of policing because those civil lawsuits do not circle back to the department. They do not become internal affairs investigations so that the conduct can be addressed individually. It does leave us in a vacuum for police accountability and abuses.
Ed, could you give us a measure of overall police misconduct since 2021 when you assumed your office? Have there any trends that your office has observed in either increases or decreases in the extent of police misconduct?
I would say since our office became operational in June of 2022, we tend to see the same types of complaints. We get a lot of vehicle crash reports being inaccurate. We get a lot of complaints about unresolved investigations, particularly homicide investigations. We get a lot of bias complaints relating to traffic stops. And externally, we have this issue of when do we do an investigation versus the department doing an investigation. So is it internally just a police matter to be investigated, or is it a civilian case to be investigated? If we have an anonymous complaint, but we can't identify a member of the public, even though it might involve sex misconduct, which comes across our desk about a quarter of the time, and which clearly is still an issue with the department. So we haven't seen any variation in the trend from when we became operational in June of 2023.
I would imagine, Ed, that because this office was created in response to Breonna Taylor's death, the fact that approximately a quarter of the cases that you've mentioned or the investigations involve homicide seems especially distressing. But I wanted to ask you if you could briefly explain the Omari Crier case. I understand that you recommended investigating possible false statements on the arrest warrant, yet the chief of police declined. What happened in that case?
Yes, Omari Crier was wanted on a felony domestic violence warrant. And when a task force involving the U.S. Marshals, Louisville Metro Police Department, and probation formed, he was the first target of this task force for arrest. And when they approached him, he fled. While he fled, he did pull out a weapon, and while fleeing and hopping over a fence, he was shot and killed by a U.S. Marshal. Our office did not have jurisdiction to review the use of deadly force because the shooter, in this case, the user of deadly force, was the U.S. Marshal. But as a part of our memorandum of understanding, every officer involved shooting that has a member of LMPD associated with it comes to us for a review. And while we did that review, we've found some areas of concern. We found that the investigator, the detective, the domestic violence investigator, the extent of her investigation was 2 phone calls to the victim and then simply reviewing the body camera of the responding officer for the original incident. That happened 6 weeks after the original incident. And this detective took to the charging attorney statements that said that the victim had lost consciousness. While in the file, the form, the domestic violence form, specifically said that she did not black out and lose consciousness. So we believed that the charges may have been brought with inaccurate information. We also believed that the protective sweep that the task force and LMPD conducted at the residence from which Mr. Cryer fled violated the Fourth Amendment rights of that household because it wasn't proximate enough to the seizure of Mr. Cryer. He was shot a couple of streets away. And so I don't believe under Bowie v. Maryland, there was enough proximity to allow for a protective sweep. And on the body camera of the officers doing the quote unquote protective sweep, you could see them searching through cabinets and things and areas that could not contain a body. And then thirdly, the fact that they did that protective sweep and found contraband, which they moved and then justified for a search warrant for the home, we believed that those three areas needed to be investigated because we believed that they were out of policy as it relates to Louisville Metro Police Department. The chief refused to do the investigation, and it illustrated some of the holes in our system. And much like some of the challenges that we're seeing now to the Constitution, it really requires that everyone who's acting within the system act within good faith. Ultimately, the chief's decision was to not conduct the investigations requested, and that's all we could do at this point.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Heidi Bogosian, and I'm here with my co-host Stephen Rohde. We're talking with Ed Harness about the future of police oversight in Louisville.
Ed, you're a board member at large for the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. The very title tells us the importance of such an organization. Just briefly tell us about that organization, how long you've been involved, and what has the group achieved over the years?
Yes, I've been with a member of NACOL since 2015, when I assumed my role as the executive director of the Civilian Police Oversight Agency in Albuquerque. And NACOL has about 1,000 members across the United States, 240 or so civilian oversight entities across the United States. Probably not one of them are exactly alike because there's such a hybrid of how the communities want their oversight entities to operate. There's fundamentally a lot of training that NACOL provides for all of these civilian entities across the United States. Aside from the training, they've established standards for civilian oversight entities, guidelines for volunteer boards, guidance for how to select leadership of civilian oversight entities, and guidance for conducting the craft, along with an annual conference that takes place. This year, we will be in Minneapolis in October. And I'm happy to say that in 2026, Louisville will host the NACOL National Annual Conference.
Ed, I understand that your term ends in November and that you've expressed interest in continuing in what must be one of the most difficult jobs in the country. What remains unfinished and what do you still hope to accomplish if reappointed?
Well, I don't think that we are conducting oversight as envisioned by the ordinance yet. We haven't gotten to the point where I believe that we're fully conducting our duties under the ordinance. And I want to continue working towards that mission. I want to continue working towards the mission as it is outlined in the mayor and the chief's community commitment, which defines some of our role and actually gives us a little more power than we have under the ordinance. And I want to maintain the continuity of what we've established. I think if I were not to be reappointed, then there would have to be a search for another inspector general. And then another inspector general would then have to reestablish a relationship with the department, which it's taken us 3 years to establish what we have now. And I think someone coming in would have to reestablish that, because no matter who the inspector general is, the Louisville Metro Police Department is not going to welcome them with open arms, shall we say. That hasn't been my experience. So that relationship would have to start anew.
Ed, you've served both in law enforcement and in roles holding law enforcement accountable amid resistance from entrenched institutions that you've alluded to, and frankly, in a broader sense that you referenced, of deep concerns across the country about the Constitution and the enforcement of the rule of law. How do you personally stay hopeful and committed to civil rights work?
Well, I see progress. Certainly, I grew up in Southern California in the 60s and witnessed what was taking place there and how policing has changed. I became a police officer, and I believe in the profession of policing, and I want them to succeed because that benefits our society as a whole. And I really enjoy the work that we do. I embrace our role in public safety. And I also believe that we can add value to the police department when we're allowed to do so. And we can help with some of the changes that I think police departments are starting to realize. In some ways, police are being set up for failure right now, as it is. We ask them to do too much. The hiring pool is artificially restricted because of physical agility tests that are required, credit scores, alcohol use or drug use. All of those go away once the officer becomes sworn. So you don't have to do PT, physical training, any longer. You could file bankruptcy as a police officer and it wouldn't affect your job. And certainly, you know, there is drug and alcohol use by police officers. And they realize that they are playing a hiring game at this point. So they need to expand the pool. They need to remove U.S. citizenship as a requirement. They need to make sure that if you're eligible to work, you can become a police officer. And then they need to really evaluate who they're hiring. So, for example, here in Kentucky, you cannot hire somebody from Western Appalachia, train them for 20 weeks, and then assign them to the west side of Louisville. That's just a recipe for disaster, because culturally, that person from Appalachia is not ready to serve the west side of Louisville.
Ed, we're running out of our allotted time. How can our listeners follow the work of your office?
Well, thanks for asking. You can go to our city website, louisvilleky.gov/inspector general. You can view all of our meetings on Metro TV at Louisville KY Metro TV. You can also email us at oig@louisvilleky.gov.
Thank you so much, Ed, for joining us on Law and Disorder and for your continued work defending civil rights and public trust. And we wish you best of luck for November.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the spectacular primary victory here in New York City with national implications of the 33-year-old charismatic socialist candidate, Zohran Mamdani.
Our guest for this topic is newspaper editor John Tarleton, who closely followed the campaign and shares his many insights. Next, we will get into the details of the recent Supreme Court decision in Trump versus CASA, Inc.
Our guest, Steve Rohde, the constitutional scholar, talks about the dangerous implications of this decision in consolidating untrammeled power in the executive branch of the government.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
In a spectacular primary victory with national implications, the 33-year-old charismatic socialist Zohran Mamdani won the Democratic primary race in New York City on June 24th. He most assuredly will win the general election and become the first Muslim mayor in the fall. With broad support, especially amongst younger people, Mamdani came from way behind to win in a landslide over former 67-year-old New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo had name recognition and the support of the entire Democratic Party establishment. His campaign was well-funded to the tune of $25 million donated by super PACs and billionaires. This included a last-minute $5 million infusion by billionaire Michael Bloomberg. Cuomo was supported by most of the trade union bureaucracy. Conservative black leader Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, who was credited with getting Bernie Sanders defeated, and the charlatan Al Sharpton. Mamdani's popularity skyrocketed when New Yorkers became aware of him and his platform. His campaign recruited 40,000 volunteers who knocked on 1,500,000 doors. 20,000 people contributed small amounts to his effort. While Cuomo campaigned on fear, supporting a policeman in every subway car, Mamdani took a radically different approach. His campaign was anchored in the idea that New York should be a place that's affordable for the working and middle-class people who live there. He advocated a rent freeze, free fast buses, free childcare, and city-run grocery stores in neighborhoods who need them. He stood up for Palestinians. The core of Mamdani's campaign workers resided in the Democratic Socialists of America. He was endorsed by Bernie Sanders, AOC, and Ilhan Omar. Mamdani is the Muslim son of South Asian immigrants. His father is a professor at Columbia University, and his mother is a film director. Mamdani himself had served for 4 years as a state assembly person from Astoria, Queens. He was born in Uganda and grew up on the west side of Manhattan. He had been active supporting taxicab drivers who were financially ruined by the intrusion of Uber and Lyft into their businesses. Several committed suicide. Mamdani led a hunger strike and a successful effort to get financial help for them. We are joined today by fellow socialist John Tarleton. He is a co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Independent, a free monthly newspaper and a website publishing in New York City since 2000. He's the co-host of The Independent NewsHour on WBAI in New York City. John has led The Independent's local political coverage for the past decade and has closely followed the rise of the Democratic Socialist Movement in New York City, which played a decisive role in helping Zohran Mamdani recently win in New York City's Democratic mayoral nomination. John Tarleton, hearty welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
It's great to be here with you, Michael and Jim.
John, please tell us about yourself and how you became active in covering and supporting Zohran Mamdani, and what's he like?
Yeah, so I'm a co-founder and now editor-in-chief of The Independent. We founded the paper 25 years ago to be an alternative source of news here in New York, anti-corporate, anti-capitalist. And we've really committed to covering all sorts of radical and progressive social movements here in the city over the years. And in the past 8 or 9 years, really since Bernie's first presidential campaign, we've also covered local electoral politics very aggressively, especially when there's strong left-wing candidates running here in the city. And that's been the case often, and that's really sort of culminated in this election result for Zohran Mamdani.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent